U.S. goes to top 1%. Corrupt system. Political revolution. I put that term, political revolution, in bitchy blue ink quotes. I inched my chair away from the scent of black coffee and Quaker oats that blew my way each time Bernie said, "The proliferation of millionaires and billionaires," with the stiff-lipped B and the long, breathy airs that would come to narrate the Democratic primary. A couple of weeks later, Bernie would announce his candidacy to a scant gathering of reporters outside Congress with such a blunt lack of fanfare that he prefaced the whole thing with, "We don't have an endless amount of time." At the time, I couldn't envision how a socialist septuagenarian could almost defeat Hillary and in the process become a pop culture icon. I'd picked up enough about economic policy covering the 2008 campaign through the financial crisis, including multiple interviews with Hillary, Warren Buffett, and Obama, to recognize that Bernie wasn't sure exactly how he'd make wealth more equitably distributed. I agreed with Hillary's assessment that Bernie didn't know anything. The more I pressed him for details on how he'd implement a big bank breakup, as Larry David's SNL version of Bernie later put it, the brusquer and more irritated he became. He always returned to the same uncluttered, irrefutable point that the rich had become too rich and the American economy had gotten entirely out of whack. Toward the end of our chat, Bernie, as if he could hear my inner voice saying, "So when do we get to the part about Hillary?" said, "This is not about Hillary Clinton." No, he said if he ran his campaign, it would be about inequality, about people working longer hours and earning less than they used to. It was John Edwards and the two Americas, minus the telegenic smile, the good hair, and the love child. Exactly a year after our first coffee, Bernie and I were back in New York. But this time, I was one of hundreds of reporters who sat in the bone-dry, sunken fountain of Washington Square Park, not far from where the beatniks rioted in 1961, and Allen Ginsberg read his poetry and the 2011 Occupy Wall Street protesters had set up tents. It was 5 days before the New York primary. There were people everywhere, 27,000 by one tally, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. Or Bernie Sanders. They filled the streets of Greenwich Village, weaving through police barricades and giving the area that had long since turned condo the throwback smell of some choice kind bud. The Bernie rally had the feel of Woodstock and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory riots and an episode of Girls all rolled together in a springtime Feel the Burn bacchanal. I hadn't felt that kind of collective yearning. That massive gulp down the Kool-Aid and asked for seconds crusade for a political candidate since I climbed onto the stage set up under the St. Louis Gateway Arch on a sunny afternoon in the fall of 2008 and looked out on an ocean of 100,000 people chanting, "Obama! Obama!" A few weeks earlier in Portland, a delicate songbird had perched on Bernie's podium. "I think there may be some symbolism here," he said to the crowd of 11,000 screaming fans. Hillary had been right to brace for defeats. Hashtag Bernie Sanders went on to annihilate her in Washington and Wisconsin, Wyoming and Idaho, Hawaii and Alaska, collecting a paltry number of delegates, but a hell of a lot of chutzpah. "Do not tell Secretary Clinton, she's getting a little nervous," Bernie said in Laramie, Wisconsin. "But I believe we've got an excellent chance to win New York and a lot of delegates in that state." His swagger filtered down to the bros who believed the lamestream media and the Democratic establishment were colluding to help Hillary. The bros called me a life support system for a cunt and a cunt playing the cunt card, who clearly needed to take it like a man in the ass. The bros told me that maybe if I hadn't spent entirely too much time sucking Bill Clinton's dick, I'd appreciate Bernie's plan for free college. If I was delayed at an airport and bored, I'd write back, "You kiss your mother with that mouth?" Or, on the rare occasions the bros emailed me from a work account, I'd try to freak them out. "Are you speaking for yourself, or is this the official position of Gen Sales?" But mostly, I ignored them and told myself these were harmless white guys in their boxer shorts who couldn't find jobs or get laid and took some comfort in settling into their parents' basements to troll girl reporters. After all, I'd had my own toe dip into online trolling, minus the oral sex references, when no one would hire me. Besides, the bros weren't wrong. I didn't know fuck all about how they were feeling. I'd had no clue Bernie would become a geriatric Che, a white-haired white knight, whose promise of ending corporate greed and a rigged economy would not only win over the kids, but thrust them into open, angry revolt against Hillary. As for Hillary, she was so done with her esteemed opponent that she could hardly stand to be on the same page as Bernie at the Brooklyn debate. She didn't see any real difference between Bernie's peddling of empty promises to his hordes of sexist supporters and Trump's campaign, except that people seemed marginally better groomed at Trump rallies. One person who talked to Hillary about her views on Trump crowds versus Bernie crowds broke it down to me as, "At least white supremacists shaved." One of Hillary's favorite moments in the primary, right up there with when she captured the nomination, came when Bernie nosedived in an editorial interview with the Daily News. He appeared unable to fully explain how he'd break up the banks. "Do you think that the Fed now has that authority?" the paper asked. "Well, I don't know if the Fed has that, but I think the administration can have it." After months of saying Wall Street executives should be jailed, Bernie wasn't sure if there were laws in place to bring about such indictments. "I believe that is the case. Do I have them in front of me now, legal statutes? No, I don't," he said. He even botched a question about how he rides the subway. "You get a token and you get in," Bernie said. Wrong. Brooklyn blasted the transcript out to the press and donors. Must read. Bernie Sanders' enlightening meeting with the Daily News editorial board. They hung it on the walls. Hillary tried to rub in her New York credentials with a ride on the number 4 train, even if it took her 5 swipes of her Metro card to go through the turnstile at 161st Street in the Bronx. "Hillary Clinton's Metro card adventure, swipe, wince, repeat," the Times headline read. I walked along the security perimeter of Washington Square Park. I asked people if they thought Bernie, who as my profession liked to say, lagged significantly in the delegate math, as if a political revolution could be reduced to arithmetic, still had a chance to defeat Hillary. Aging hippies waved signs that said, "The revolution is here." A guy who looked exactly like a young Lou Reed held a poster with the words, "Democracy versus oligarchy, humanity versus greed." Even if Hillary could have attracted the same all-you-can-eat buffet of random rallying cries, her corporate campaign regularly confiscated homemade signs. Brooklyn thought it best that the everydays hold professionally produced signs that display the message du jour, rather than something made with love and some finger paint and magic marker. In Phoenix, I watched a young Clinton staffer rip from the hands of a 6-year-old girl an "I Heart Hillary" sign she'd drawn in crayon in art class that afternoon. They gave her a blue "Breaking Down Barriers" sign with the campaign's H arrow logo and HillaryClinton.com at the bottom. I dove into the crowd like an anthropologist, eager to understand why young women, in particular, weren't with her. But as I talked to so many students from NYU and their mouths moved and I followed up with, "What's your major and how do you spell Delilah?" I was secretly seething with resentment. I'd wanted to attend NYU ever since our 7th grade hobby middle school trip to Washington and New York. I remember when our tour bus arrived in Greenwich Village, our faces pressed to the windows to gaze out at Christopher Street and Stonewall. I'd never seen men holding hands before, and I distinctly remember swooning over a woman with an emerald green mohawk and black leather vest with only a black lace bra underneath. That's when Brandy said, loud enough so that I could hear her several rows in front, "Amy's so weird, I bet she wants to live here." She was right. From that point on, I was determined to go to NYU and live in a rundown dorm on McDougal Street and pierce my nose and wear a pleather skirt to the tunnel every Thursday night. For the next year of middle school and 4 years of high school, I wore an NYU t-shirt at least twice a week and acted as if going there was a done deal. I'd say, I'll be in New York by then, and I'll have to live in Greenwich Village to be close to my classes. But I'd never actually talked to my parents about this plan until my junior year. One evening, I tiptoed into my parents' bedroom in my tattered NYU shirt, holding a folder with NYU's white and purple torch that laid out the various tuition and financing options. My dad lay on the bed as he usually did late into weeknights, legal papers spread out over his lap and his brown leather briefcase propped open like a bear trap beside him. My mom sat on the floor grading papers. I'd rehearsed all of it in my head for so long. I could do a work-study program, I started. I've got all this experience hostessing already, and they have this program where... NYU wasn't up for discussion. We've talked about this, my dad said. There's a perfectly good state school an hour away in Austin. In trying to prove how adult I was, how ready I was to live in New York, I threw an absolute balls-out, arms-flailing temper tantrum. You don't know anything, I sobbed. NYU isn't a state school. It's private and prestigious. At this point, my sister Steph, who'd been on my side about fleeing Texas, she'd dreamed of Georgetown before ending up at UT, heard my fit and turned on me. You seriously think Mom and Dad are going to pay $25,000 a year so you can go be a druggie in New York? I didn't even mail in my application. I spent the $50 application fee on tickets to the Primus concert and a bag full of hallucinogenic mushrooms that my neighbor Travis grew on cow patties. I still got my nose pierced, a silver loop too big for my face that sat in a dollop of pink pus on my left nostril. This accessory lasted exactly 2 months until my mom told me they'd stop paying my UT tuition if I didn't take that crap out of your nose this second. I looked at these twiggy, unshaven girls living in the West Village on their parents' backs. They wore gray wigs with peach latex designed to look like Bernie's super-hip receding hairline. They'd had tight-fitting t-shirts with Bernie's black glasses and slogans like "Burnin' with Passion" and "Bernie is Bae" and "Brooklyn for Bernie." My envy began to fade. I'd been a brat. My dad had been right all along. The perfectly good state school an hour away and $4,000 a semester had been exactly what I needed. But I couldn't see it then. I must have seemed to him like one of the unwashed masses who couldn't see that Hillary was the obvious, practical choice. Tim Robbins stood on stage under the miniature lit-up Arc de Triomphe at Washington Square Park. We are supporting a candidate that has taken principled positions when others have compromised, he said. What a radical concept, a politician that has a moral bottom line. Democrats were facing a general election against Trump, and Bernie's campaign was still saying Hillary was the one who lacked a moral bottom line. She was a Methodist minister compared to Trump. But you'd never know talking to the crowd that night. The dozens of Bernie lovers I interviewed told me they wanted to read the transcripts of Hillary's Wall Street speeches. They hadn't forgiven her for voting for the Iraq War. They bemoaned her billionaire donors and her pussyfooting around whether she supported a $15 minimum wage. I think setting the goal to get to $12 is the way to go, encouraging others to get to $15, she said in the Brooklyn debate. They said she'd shamed Monica Lewinsky and that she'd been bought and paid for by corporations. Everything Trump would throw at Hillary and then some hurled from the glossy lips of college girls that night. The day before the New York primary was a 27-hour whirlwind trailing Hillary as she posed for photos with Latino workers at the high-tech car wash and lube, slogan, Lube It or Lose It, in Elmhurst. I've campaigned at a lot of gas stations, some of which had car washes, but this is special. Sipped tapioca bubble tea in Chinatown in Flushing. I've never had squishy tea before. And at an East Village artisanal ice cream shop owned by an ex-con, broke her rule of never eating in front of the press and devoured a milk chocolate and waffle ice cream concoction named The Victory. It ended that night with the Irish. The travelers filed into the courtyard of the Fitzpatrick Hotel near Grand Central. A little gym owned by the donor, an eligible bachelor, John Fitzpatrick, that my Irish family, and no one else I knew, considered the height of New York luxury. Bill Clinton in a green tie and an Irish fiddle player warmed up the crowd. "Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Hillary has spent an entire lifetime taking the stones out of the heart by making good things happen." I'd heard Bill butcher lines of Yeats for years, but that one seemed particularly creative. After they learned that the Times Hillary reporter is married to a Mead man, as in County Mead, New York's Irish power brokers adopted me as one of their own. I had a lot of sleazy sources whom I'd never spend time with if they weren't potentially useful, see Hands Across America. But the Irish were like family. I loved their dark sense of humor and morose worldview. In the midst of the New York primary, I received anti-Semitic mail, including a brochure that showed a stereotypical Jew with a black top hat and exaggerated elongated nose rising above the earth and engulfed in voracious flames over the words, "Evil Jews in charge." An Irish friend took one look at it and shrugged. "Eh, at least you're in charge." I stayed around to drink a Magners, the Irish cider that I'd learned to order in lieu of Guinness. Strings of translucent lights hung overhead, and the fiddler played the reedy chords of Rocky Road to Dublin. I asked Bill how he first bonded with the Irish. This led to a 10-minute walk down memory lane about how the Irish had helped a redneck governor from Arkansas win the New York primary in 1992 and how, in turn, he'd approved Jerry Adams' visa and helped end the Troubles. "You didn't used to care about this when you went to New York. You just wanted the Irish to vote for you," he said. I got home after midnight. I'd only had one pint but felt drunk. We had to be back on the van at 5:45 a.m. to watch Hillary vote in Chappaqua. That morning, a light drizzle fell outside Douglas Grafflin Elementary School, where Hillary's well-heeled neighbors stood under golf umbrellas and held handmade signs and chanted, "Hillary, and we love you!" Inside the basketball gym, Hillary leaned over to cast a ballot for herself. The travelers barreled around her. We yelled our evergreen question, "Secretary, how are you feeling about tonight?" Hillary snapped, "Guys, it's a private ballot," and signaled to brown loafers, "Can we get the press out of here, please?" By the time Hillary came outside, the rain had stopped. The clouds had parted and the sun beat down. Again, that question. "How are you feeling about tonight?" Hillary looked over her shoulder at us. "I love New York," she said. She bulldozed Bernie by 16 points and came on stage at the Sheridan that night to 2,500 screaming New Yorkers, and the slow beat of Empire State of Mind filled the ballroom. "Concrete jungle where dreams are made of, there's nothing you can't do." I'd already filed my story and lifted myself over the barricade set up around the press area to watch. I'd asked for an embargoed draft of Hillary's remarks, and a source friend in Brooklyn instead texted me a meme of Sally Field accepting her second Oscar, arms hoisted overhead, and the words, "You like me. You really like me." Chapter 36, Writing Herstory. I often want to cry. That is the only advantage women have over men. At least they can cry. Jean Rhys. Brooklyn, June 2016. At 8:21 p.m. ET, on Monday, June 6, 2016, Hillary made history in the most Hillary way possible. The Associated Press flashed across the wire. Breaking, AP finds Clinton reached the number of delegates needed to clinch the Democratic nomination for president. Hillary had done something no woman in the 228-year history of the Republic had ever come close to doing. Thing was, California hadn't voted yet. She planned to do the whole history-making hurrah the following night in Brooklyn under the glass dome ceiling of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, 8 years to the day after she dropped out of the 2008 primary. But the AP called a bunch of uncommitted superdelegates, those pesky party elders who got to vote for whatever candidate they wanted, regardless of the will of the voters. That got Hillary to the magic 2,838 number of delegates needed to become the nominee. She didn't want to win that way. The Bernie camp was already pushing the idea that Hillary would only win because of the party's funky, undemocratic electoral system. She'd win because of the establishment. Hillary stood backstage at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles when she saw the headline. She waited a while to go on stage as John Legend introduced her and downplayed the news. "I don't care what the AP says about who won the nomination," he said. "We need everybody to vote tomorrow." She didn't care about the other five states voting on Tuesday, but she couldn't lose California. Couldn't even be close, or everyone would talk about her weaknesses and we'd all write that even though she made history, she hobbled to her party's nomination. Earlier that afternoon, I was in the New York office watching a gaggle on TV. Hillary had been shaking hands at a senior center in Compton when the travelers gathered around to ask about the heft of what she'd accomplished. She responded with her usual stoic restraint. "I am really just so focused on all of the states that are voting tomorrow. That is my singular focus, because I know that there's a lot of work still going on." Pressed again, Hillary didn't waver. "I'm going to wait until everyone has voted. Tomorrow night we will have a chance to talk more about this." I thought back to one of the low points in the 14-month campaign when a woman at a town hall in Vegas asked Hillary for a hug and she'd replied, "Sit down right there. When I finish my Q&A, I will give you that hug, I promise. Sit right there, and when I kick Bernie's ass in California, I'll acknowledge the historic moment I've spent decades dreaming of and the generations of women have hoped for. I promise." When the AP headline moved across the wires, I was on the F train, and specifically in the black hole between West 4th Street and Broadway Lafayette, the only stretch on my commute when I lost service entirely. 8:27 p.m. ET. "Next stop, Delancey, Essex," the conductor muttered. That's when I saw the tweets, saw all the missed calls and voicemails, scrolled through the frantic emails flooding in. I felt the stab in the gut when I read a note from Carolyn. Maggie and Nick did a quick cut. For 8 years, ever since Hillary declared under the atrium of the National Building Museum in Washington that 18 million cracks had been made in that highest, hardest glass ceiling, I'd imagined the night she'd finally become the nominee and thought about what my story would say. Now, after 2 presidential campaigns and 5 months of primaries and caucuses, it had finally happened, and I'd been in the bowels of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority as a couple of colleagues who happened to be in the newsroom wrote the first draft. In the approximately 6 minutes I'd been underground, a heated newsroom-wide debate had erupted about how to handle the AP's call. Everyone had an opinion. Nobody asked me, but isn't this a bit of an AP News gimmick? For what it's worth, this is also how the AP got to the 1,237 number for Trump, calling superdelegates and getting them to commit on the record. It's like the AP is reporting her way into the nomination, as opposed to waiting for her to win it tomorrow. At this stage, after months of primaries and caucuses and a big day tomorrow, I wouldn't go big with this. They did the same damn thing in 2008. You could write a story attributed to the AP but hedging if you're not ready to buy the whole hog, or you could declare it over and run the story you intended to run tomorrow. I can imagine some of the more devoted Sanders fans have some strong feelings about the timing of this. I was a block away from our apartment, passing the Chinese bodega with the handmade "We Sell Beer" sign and scrolling through the emails to try to figure out if anyone had come up with a plan. I landed on Carolyn's definitive, "really need everything" message. I picked up into a jog. My colleagues had saved my ass and gotten a couple of quick graphs onto the homepage as a placeholder until we could get a longer version online and in the next day's paper. My back wasn't spasming the way it usually did when I ran under the weight of my laptop, chargers, a change of shoes, and a few bottles of water. When I stopped to look for my keys, I realized why my backpack felt light. I'd left my laptop at the office. By the time Bobby heard me rummaging around for my keys and opened the door, I was hyperventilating. For weeks, I'd started to pour everything I knew about Hillary's life, all her contradictions about what her career meant for women and our rapidly changing expectations of ourselves, into a tight 1,200-word story that would run when she captured the nomination and which was partially written on a laptop that was half an hour away in Times Square. I tried to use Bobby's computer, a brick of an old HP that we named Big Eddie. But after 5 minutes trying to browse Internet Explorer, Big Eddie overheated and crashed. I called the office. Nick Corisanti, a Trump reporter who appreciates cheap eats and surfing in that order, was about to leave for the night. I lured him to the Lower East Side with my laptop and the promise that he could also pick up a poke bowl at Dimes, the California cool eatery down the street. I couldn't stop working long enough to run downstairs. Bobby went down for the laptop, sprinted upstairs, and stretched my MacBook Air toward me like a relay race runner passing the baton. Pat had been at the gym when the news broke. By then, we'd teamed up on dozens of stories about the Democratic primary. But Pat covered the Republican primary, too. Pat covered everything. Trump favored him, calling him my smart Irish. Pat could churn out a perfectly crafted front-page Times story during a commercial break, with 16 colleagues, 5 editors, and a cranky copy editor shouting unsolicited advice at him. I needed his help with this one. He wiped off his sweat and headed to the newsroom so we could team up on the story. We filed the story in 200-word chunks as we wrote it so that editors could piece it all together in real time. The copy desk came up with the careful headline, "Clinton Reaches Historic Mark, AP Says." The "I wouldn't go big with this" contingent lost. The story ran across 6 columns on the front page. Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone, the first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee for the President of the United States, Hillary said 24 hours later in Brooklyn. In 2008, Mark Penn had advised she run as a man, and I'd raced out of an auditorium in Salem, New Hampshire, to try to talk to the man who'd waved a yellow sign and interrupted Hillary with chants of, "Iron my shirt!" In her potpourri of a 2016 announcement speech a year earlier in Roosevelt Island, even the feminist lines were sort of about men. Hillary said she dreamed of an America where a father can tell his daughter, "Yes, you can be anything you want to be, even President of the United States." Bernie supporters, Republicans, and garden variety Hillary haters always told me it wasn't about gender. They'd vote for a woman, just not that woman. Hillary walked on stage in Brooklyn wearing white for the suffragettes. I wanted to scream at every critic that 30 years of sexist attacks had turned her into that woman, that sooner or later, the higher we climb, the harder we work, we all become that woman. Hillary stretched out her wingspan wide enough to embrace the entire screaming crowd, all the little girls hoisted on their fathers' shoulders. Okay, so most of their fathers were Wall Street donors, but she spoke in language of social activism, always "we" instead of "I," as in the history we've made here. She took the stage after a video showed the women of Seneca Falls, Shirley Chisholm, Gloria Steinem, and Hillary's own "Women's Rights Are Human Rights" declaration in Beijing, putting the evening into the context of decades of struggles in the women's movement. I'd sent an early glance of the introductory video around the newsroom. A male editor replied, "Where are all the men?" The Drudge Report headline read, "I am woman, hear me roar." Hillary devoted the victory to her mother, Dorothy, born June 4, 1918, the same day Congress passed the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote. I wish she could see her daughter become the Democratic nominee for President of the United States, she said. She wasn't a blubbering Lifetime movie, but at this point Hillary was clearly fighting back tears. In 2008, I'd been a couple of feet away from Hillary at a diner in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, when the waterworks burst. Jamie had stepped outside for a second and missed it. The guys called panicked, asking her what the hell happened. The teary moment became an earth-shattering inflection point debated by political pundits and historians for years to come. I considered it progress that 8 years later, Hillary cried all the time and no one really noticed. There was the time backstage in Manchester when a part-time librarian told Hillary his 84-year-old mother had Alzheimer's and he couldn't afford her care, so I'd take her to work with me. Her eyes welled. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And there was the town hall in Kyoto, Iowa, when 10-year-old Hannah Tandy asked Hillary what she would do about bullying. Can you tell me a little bit more about why that's on your mind? Hillary asked. I have asthma, and occasionally I hear people talking behind my back, Hannah said. A teary Hillary pulled Hannah in under one arm. Brooklyn promptly turned the interaction into an anti-Trump ad. I'd been more sentimental than usual, too. When Hillary said her mother taught me never to back down from a bully, which it turns out was pretty good advice, my thoughts drifted to the Bernie bros. I'd spent most of my day the way other women covering Hillary had, fending off death threats from the bros who thought we prematurely called the race in Hillary's favor. The colorful strings of expletives I'd grown used to, even amused by, became more violent. Several bros called my number at the Times to tell me the revolution was coming for me. One of them left a voicemail about how he knew my type of rich bitch. Others seemed to read from a script that went something like, "You lying, Hillary-loving cunt, we will hunt you down in the fucking streets." I needed to bask in some girl power, or at least commiserate with my fellow Hillary-loving cunts. Before Hillary took the stage on an esplanade of the Brooklyn Navy Yard overlooking the Brooklyn Bridge, my closest female friends among the travelers, Ruby Kramer, Annie Carney, Jennifer Epstein, and I posed for a photo. We are in our typical position, guzzling down iced coffee and cradling our laptops as if they were newborns. We made it through the primaries. We were there to write herstory, as Jen Epps called it. And for about 15 minutes, it felt damn good. I was back to reality when I ended up watching Hillary's speech through the isosceles triangle of a photographer's denim thighs after he'd parked his schlubby ass right in front of me on the press riser just as she took the stage. Herstory, as witnessed through the filter of a male crotch. Making matters worse, I looked over at the second press riser, even closer to the stage, and saw a shih tzu that appeared to have Bell's palsy, his pink tongue falling out one side of his furry, lopsided face, sitting on a cozy pillow with a prime view. After the speech, I climbed off the riser and raced over to Hired Gun Guy to rip into him that a dog had been assigned a better position on the press riser than the Times. "That fucking dog in his little doggy bed had a prime view," I'd said. "You're kidding me, right?" Hired Gun replied. "That's Marnie the dog. He has like 2 million followers on Instagram. Sorry, but the Shih Tzu has more reach than the Times and the AP. The next day, another story I'd written in my head ever since Hillary's 2008 concession speech ran on the front page under the headline, "Hillary Clinton's Long, Grueling Quest." To me, the single moment that encapsulated Hillary's path to the Democratic nomination wasn't her sun-splashed campaign kickoff in New York, or her speeches celebrating hard-fought primary victories, but the unscripted instant during her 8 hours of testimony to the Republican-led Benghazi committee when a blasé Miss Clinton coolly brushed from her shoulder a speck of lint, dirt, or perhaps nothing at all. The next day, Hillary agreed to give the print reporters interviews, something we'd been collectively requesting for months. I had 12 minutes on the phone that I stretched into 14 minutes and 35 seconds, only because I turned the conversation to our summer reading lists. Hillary said she planned to hit the Chappaqua bookstore. I love to wander around bookstores and see what strikes my fancy and hear what the people who work there recommend, she said. I asked her what the last book she read was, and she recommended Diana Nyad's memoir, Find a Way, about her nearly 111-mile swim at age 64 from Cuba to Florida. It is something that when you're facing big challenges in your life, you can think about Diana Nyad getting attacked by the lethal sting of box jellyfish, and nearly anything else seems doable in comparison, Hillary said. Is Donald Trump the box jellyfish in this scenario? I asked. Hillary let out one of those guttural Hillary belly laughs. I don't know about that. Chapter 37. Who Let the Dog Out? A Tarmac in Phoenix, June 2016. In the span of a couple months, Bill Clinton's conversations on private tarmacs went like this. He chatted with Orrin G. Hatch in Louisville after speaking at Muhammad Ali's funeral. He ran into Paul D. Ryan and gave the Republican speaker a polite piece of his mind. He said a quick hello to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and in Mobile, Alabama, he even shook hands with Ted Cruz, despite the Texas Republican having recently called for Hillary's imprisonment. But in late June, with the Democratic primaries over and everyone saying the fall election was Hillary's to lose, Bill made 20 minutes of tarmac small talk that altered the course of the race. In the midst of a 10-city fundraising swing, he stepped off the scorching asphalt at the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport and onto the airplane of the Attorney General whose Justice Department was investigating his wife's handling of emails at the State Department. It took a while for anyone in Brooklyn to learn about the tarmac chat with Loretta Lynch, and even then they didn't initially see it as much of a problem. Josh Schwerin, the press aide who accompanied Clinton on the trip, didn't think to tell Brooklyn. Josh's status as the youngest of the Schwerin brothers after Ben, who worked in the Clinton White House, and Dan, who had interned in Hillary's Senate office until he worked his way up to the chief speechwriter position, protected him. But for a few days, when Lynch distanced herself and said she'd accept the FBI Director James Comey's decision in the email investigation, the well-meaning kid thought for sure he'd be fired. I sympathized with Josh. In keeping with my inability to gauge Clinton scandals, I didn't initially realize that a little tarmac small talk would become a major story either. When I first ran it by my editors, they told me I could skip it. I don't know why Clinton did it. Lynch later said Clinton came over mostly to say hello and talk about his grandchildren and his travels and things like that, and that no discussions were held into any cases or things like that. The worst Democrats would say about the meeting on the record was that it had been irresponsible. The guys returned to the lovable St. Bernard defense. He just wanted to say hello to an old friend and talk about the grandkids. There were theories that Clinton subconsciously didn't want Hillary to be president, but I didn't believe those, especially not when it meant his surname would forever be associated with giving the world Donald Trump. FOBs told me he probably was trying to influence Lynch, not directly, but just a mild charm offensive that he thought would help Hillary. OTR read a text message from a source who knew Clinton better than most, shortly after news of the meeting broke. President Clinton is irresponsible like a fox. Chapter 38. Man, y'all are jittery. Fear can be conquered, anxiety has to be endured. Max Brooks, Mindcraft, The Island. North Carolina to Florida, July 2016. We all stood there in our own worlds, me, Michael Shear, a White House correspondent, and Matt Flegenheimer, a.k.a. Flegg, a wunderkind who'd been on the Ted Cruz beat and would now help out with Hillary coverage. We'd all flown into Charlotte, North Carolina to cover Hillary's first joint rally with Obama. But as soon as we landed, we learned that the rally wasn't the news, not even close. I'd spent the 4th of July weekend focused on two activities. Continuing my habit of overcorrecting and going full Martha Stewart when I was home, I baked Bobby a flag cake and decorated it with white icing and rows of strawberries and blueberries. And I'd written about Hillary, accompanied by five of her lawyers, sitting down for 3.5 hours of questions from 8 FBI and Department of Justice officials. In any other election year, the sight of the leading candidate for the presidency and her phalanx of lawyers strolling into the J. Edgar Hoover building would have shattered the political universe. But this was 2016. By late morning on July 5th, when our American Airlines flight landed at Charlotte Douglas International Airport, the FBI director, James Comey, had given a press conference in which he recommended no criminal charges be brought against Hillary's use of private email. But, and with Hillary, there was always a but. He also said that she and her State Department aides had been extremely careless in handling classified information. We stood at the Hertz rental car counter, alternating between checking Twitter and throaty gulps of iced coffee. We shook with the edgy irritation that only comes from flying to a place thinking you'll write the big story and then realizing once you've landed that you've missed the story entirely. Adding to this agitated stew was the dynamic with my newly installed sidekicks on the Hillary beat. Flegg, with the slumped posture, sense of humor, and prose style of a Times reporter several decades older than his 27 years, and Tom Kaplan, a Minchie boy genius with too many Ivy League degrees to be sending me feeds from a town hall in Akron. I adored both like the little brothers I always wanted, and the travel and daily story demands were too much for any one reporter. But I'd never shared the Hillary beat before. I remembered my days as a starting point guard in Texas, prone to offensive fouls. Mine, mine, mine! We tried to stream highlights of the Comey press conference while all talking into our earpieces at once. No, the story needs to run tonight. And, just landed, need anything from me on the Comey presser? And, does this mean we're bumped off the front? The Obama endorsement became such a non-story that our editors asked us to chunk it up. In Times speak, chunky journalism means the listicles of photos with snappy captions, tailor-made for millennials to scroll through on iPhones. I'm not opposed to the idea, but I hated the name. I didn't want to be called chunky, and neither did my journalism. When I raised this concern, a politics editor proposed tapas journalism instead. Who doesn't like tapas? That's when we realized the woman behind the Hertz counter was looking at us up and down, her eyebrows peaked. She shook her head and as she handed over the keys, said in a slow southern timbre, "Man, y'all are jittery." 2 weeks later, on a hotel patio overlooking a man-made lake in Orlando, I reached peak jittery. Everyone was in Cleveland to cover the Republican National Convention, but I'd flown into Orlando the night before to meet up with Hillary. It takes a lot to make me envious of a Red Roof Inn on the outskirts of Cleveland, but being left behind for the sole purpose of trying to break who Hillary would choose as her VEEP was worse. Trying to scoop the VEEP was one of those competitive sports in campaign reporting that made me wish I were still wandering around Shibuya writing stories about oxygen-infused water and the latest hot tub karaoke craze. The history books hardly took note of running mates, never mind the hack reporters who spent months trying to break the story. Get it right, and you were rewarded with the warm bath of 3 minutes tops of praise on Twitter from a tiny clique of political reporters. But get it wrong, and you'd live in Dewey defeats Truman infamy, which very nearly happened to me 8 years earlier. I was sitting on the toilet at the Intercontinental Hotel on Chicago's Magnificent Mile with my BlackBerry in hand, waiting for the late-night text from the Obama campaign to announce his vice presidential pick. My journal editor, whose steady neurosis and Harvard economics degree made him both brilliant and unsuited to steer political coverage, sent out a news alert that went something like this. WSJ breaking news. Senator Barack Obama chooses Virginia Governor Tim Kaine as his running mate. I bolted up as if an earthquake shook the ground beneath me and pants around my ankles called the desk. Take that down immediately. I never said it was Kaine. Take it down now. I'd escaped calamity that time, but there would be no way, as a Times reporter in the Twitter era, that the internet would be so forgiving again. I'd fallen off Carolyn's radar as she focused on the GOP side. There was only one way to regain the twinkle Carolyn bestowed on the reporters who brought her the biggest, the yummiest, the hardest to get scoops. I needed to break the VEEP news. I needed to make Mama happy. I'd spent a week practically alone in the newsroom chasing every wacko lead. I read two books by James G. Stavridis, a retired four-star Navy admiral, before a senior aide told me he gave new meaning to the words shortlist. Have you seen James Stavridis? He stood a couple of inches shorter than Hillary without her kitten heels. I recruited a body language expert to study Hillary's demeanor, including the brush-off she gave to Cory Booker after he spent 13 minutes sucking up to her at a rally. This included quoting Maya Angelou, Abraham Lincoln, and John Bon Jovi. "I hate to contradict Bon Jovi," Booker said, "but dear God, Hillary Clinton, you give love a good name." Hillary patted him on the back, a gesture that reminded me of the time Matt Paul, her campaign's former Iowa State director, had tripped as he shuffled alongside the rope line next to her. "That's Matt Paul," Hillary said. "He's from Iowa, and he's doing the best he can." "That's Cory. He's from New Jersey, and he's doing the best he can." I'd flown to Orlando the night before and watched Trump's "I Alone Can Fix It" acceptance speech in my heavily air-conditioned hotel room while texting with one of my most credible sources. I'll call him Sean. Sean assured me Kane was the guy. They figure if she wins Virginia, Trump has no path. Jen Palmieri, intent on avoiding leaks, could smell the fragrant stew of desperation and self-doubt on me. "Your Veep source," the subject of one email read, "is either terrible or deliberately messing with you." I held an eyelash between my finger and thumb and blew into the humid July air. I wish this day were over and the Veep news was behind me. A draft of my "Hillary Chooses Tim Kaine as Running Mate" story was edited and ready to publish. I told my editors to hold off and texted Sean again. "What's the latest? You still hearing Kaine?" I patiently gave him 2 full minutes to reply and texted again. "Are you there? Are you pissed at me?" The bouncing dots appeared. "Don't worry. Nothing changed overnight. She's not going to cross Bill, never has, and has McAuliffe's support, too." The travelers were even more high-strung than usual. With Cleveland behind them, all our editors had turned to Hillary. They called us all non-stop under the laughable assumption that traveling with the campaign must mean we knew what was happening in the campaign. Hillary held a roundtable discussion with community leaders to talk about the aftermath of the Pulse nightclub massacre a month earlier. After that, she went to Pulse to lay a dozen white roses at a makeshift vigil for the 49 victims. I watched Hillary walk past Catholic prayer candles in glass jars, rainbow flags, bunches of fresh sunflowers, and a collage of faces so young they could have been high school yearbook pictures. Whom she picked as her Veep had never felt so beside the point. The day dragged on. The Hillary picks Kaine story sat unpublished. The text messages flooded in. We were at the Florida State Fairgrounds in Tampa when one of the possible Veep picks texted to tell me Podesta had called him to tell him it wasn't him. Sean texted again. "Any second, go for it." A press aide yelled, "Loading," as she led the travelers through a pitch-black warehouse adjacent to the fairgrounds. I could hear the stampede of the travelers but couldn't see anything. My iPhone lit up. It was my colleague Jonathan Martin, who knew Virginia politics better than anyone. "Kaine," a second later, "go with it." I called the desk and told them to publish. The rush of adrenaline, the darkness, the sense of dread if we didn't get it right, all made me feel as if I were wading through a haunted house. Roughly 8 minutes later, Brooklyn blasted out the official announcement. The text to supporters read, "I'm thrilled to tell you this first. I've chosen Senator Tim Kaine as my running mate. Welcome him to our team, Amy." Hired gun guy tried to smoke out our source. "Based on your sourcing, should I assume someone on the campaign confirmed it ahead of the text?" he emailed. I took more satisfaction than I should have in sending back an emoji smiling face with his lips zipped. Brooklyn settled on another theory to explain how the news had not only leaked, but been attributed to a source inside the campaign. They thought I'd pretended to use the bathroom at the Tampa Fairgrounds and eavesdropped on Jen and Huma, who stood behind a nearby curtain and loudly discussed the logistics of Hillary and Kane's meeting later that night in Miami. I wish I'd thought of that. After weeks of misleading us and telling us our sources were full of shit, the guys climbed onto the press bus to make sure we all wrote the same dramatic, highly favorable TikTok. Brown Loafers delivered a readout that went like this. Podesta had visited Hillary in Chappaqua after the New York primary with Duane Reade bags full of binders with background on potential vice presidential candidates. He told us how Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea bonded with the Kane family over lunch, and how aides had slipped out of Brooklyn via freight elevator to usher Kane away from a Newport fundraiser and fly him incognito to Miami. We all wrote down April and Duane Reade bags and Newport fundraiser. The headlines came out exactly as planned. Behind the choice, how Hillary selected her running mate. And car chases and secret getaways, Tim Kaine's wild 78 hours. The guys didn't mention that Podesta and Cheryl started the vetting process way before the New York primary. In mid-March, Podesta passed on a list of possible Veeps arranged into food groups. This balanced diet included Latinos, Tom Perez, Julian Castro, women, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Blacks, Cory Booker, Eric Holder, white male politicians, Tim Kaine, Terry McAuliffe, military men, John Allen, Mike Mullen, and assorted billionaires and businessmen, Bill Gates, Mike Bloomberg, Tim Cook. 39th and last on the list in a food group all his own was Bernie Sanders. The press charter to fly us to Miami that night hadn't even started to taxi when I pulled down my tray table and popped open a Pabst Blue Ribbon. I closed my eyes and listened to John Coltrane and felt my restlessness recede into the tenor saxophone of a love supreme. With the Veep pick behind us, the end was in sight. I could do this. In 3 months, the campaign would be over. The steel cage match would disassemble. I could put a close to my years of only covering Hillary in the defensive crouch of a presidential campaign. I zoned out the window at the dark, swampy air, wondering what Hillary would be like to cover as president. Sure, we just had a convention and a general election to get through, but how bad could that be? And right when I expected to feel the skip of the wheels as they lifted off the tarmac for Miami, we were told there was a crew rest issue and the plane couldn't fly. The pilot and flight attendants started to deplane. Brown Loafers, who on any other night would have flown on Hillary's jet, which was well on its way to Miami, called Brooklyn to figure out how to get us out of Tampa. The prognosis wasn't good. We had two options. We could track down a bus and drive the 280 miles to Miami, or we could spend the night at an airport hotel and fly out at 6 the following morning. Brown Loafers burst from his seat in disbelief, stuck in the great coastal shithole of Tampa Bay. Bill Nelson, the Florida senator and former astronaut who flew on the mission right before the Challenger exploded, had been in Hillary's rally and hitched a flight to Miami on the press plane. Hearing this debate unfold, somebody suggested that Nelson fly the plane. This led to a split among the travelers. Is that a good idea? Yeah, I don't know. Is that even allowed? I'd hardly spoken to anyone on the bus that day, but I took off my earphones and yelled down the aisle, "The man flew the fucking space shuttle! I'm pretty sure he can handle a rent-a-jet on a 30-minute flight to Miami!" I lost. We would spend the night at a Renaissance near the airport attached to a mall called the International Plaza. At the bar of the Capitol Grill, I ordered a dry-aged porterhouse and 3 glasses of a Napa Valley Pinot before the bartender announced last call. I walked back to the hotel nice and buzzed, weaving through a series of outdoor walkways made to look like a street in Roman Holiday, but with sports bars and a California pizza kitchen. Stuck in the great coastal shithole of Tampa Bay, and for the first time in months, I was free. Chapter 39, The Bedwetters. Washington, D.C. to Atlantic City, Atlantic City to New York City, summer 2016. Democrats started to worry. When Trump called Bill Clinton a rapist on Fox News, Hillary responded by telling CNN, "I have concluded he is not qualified to be president." Brooklyn was elated that she'd really gone there. She actually called the presumptive Republican nominee unfit, hired gun guy said. Yeah, but he did call her husband a rapist, I said. When Trump suggested he'd reduce the national debt by negotiating with creditors to accept less than a full payment, one of his more batshit ideas that would have led to global economic calamity, Brooklyn issued a press release calling the proposal risky. Hillary was still following the Mitt Romney playbook, not realizing that she was the Romney in the race. She tried to make Trump a cold corporate titan who got rich screwing over the little guy. She had an event in Atlantic City with the fading outline of the Trump Plaza casino sign in the background. Just down the boardwalk is the Trump Taj Mahal. Donald once called it the eighth wonder of the world, Hillary said. She liked trolling Trump and smiled a little as she gestured toward the decrepit hotel, now dotted with busted light bulbs and dust-covered faux gold urns. She tried to make her put-down snack-sized. People get hurt and Donald gets paid. But Trump wasn't Romney. He could have a car elevator and no one would care. Reporters would ask for rides on the damn thing. Meanwhile, Trump feasted on the FBI press conference and his rat-a-tat recitation of Crooked Hillary, while she criticized his plan to eliminate the estate tax and cut corporate tax rates. Sometimes you get the feeling they're in a professional boxing match and he's in a street fight, and they're coming in with their gloves on, Reverend Al Sharpton said. This is a street fight with a guy with a razor and a broken Coca-Cola bottle. You gotta fight him like that. Chuck Schumer told Jonathan Martin that he'd implored Brooklyn to hire a senior staffer whose only job was to respond to Trump on an hourly basis. John Hickenlooper, the Colorado governor, said he was reading The Art of the Deal and that Hillary has to be careful because now he, Trump, has the momentum. Matthew Dowd, a former chief strategist to George W. Bush, who is now an independent, told me in late February, Hillary has built a large tanker ship, and she's about to confront Somali pirates. Brooklyn blew it all off. The math was on their side. It wouldn't be a general election without some early bedwetting from Washington insiders, Robbie said. No caller ID flashed on my phone. I'd left the newsroom and was sitting in Bryant Park to soak up the early summer air and clear my head. It was June, days before Hillary would win the nomination. People with normal jobs spread picnic blankets and wine and brie out on the lawn as a trio of flamenco guitarists set up on a temporary stage. Hello? Amy, it's Donald Trump. In a speech in San Diego, Hillary had finally delivered the takedown Democrats wanted to hear, mixing in her wit and signature sarcasm. Megan Rooney, who, like Dan Schwerin, worked with Hillary at the State Department, perched on the armrest of Hillary's luxe leather seat on the flight to San Diego to hammer out the most lacerating lines. Hillary looked like she was enjoying herself when she called Trump's foreign policy pronouncements not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies. This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into war just because somebody got under his very thin skin, she said. Trump had called the Times during the speech to yell into the phone, I'm not thin-skinned at all. I'm the opposite of thin-skinned. The day before, Policy Guy gave me a rundown of what the speech would say so that I could write a curtain raiser. When Carolyn came back from the page one meeting with the most beautiful words in the English language, they want it for the front, I reached out to the Trump campaign for comment. I expected a statement from Hope Hicks, Trump's competent and responsive spokeswoman. Instead, Trump called directly. In this period, most of my colleagues had stories of standing in line at Starbucks or climbing onto the elliptical when the infamous no-caller ID Trump call came in. I'd spent months requesting interviews with Hillary. Always the answer from Brooklyn, no matter how positive or substantive the topic, was either stone-cold silence or a hard no. But there I was in Bryant Park, picking up my phone to, Hi, Amy, this is Donald Trump. I dug around in my bag for a pen and pulled out some loose scraps of paper. Trump repeated the phrase America first at least 6 times, attributing his favorite pet phrase to your very good, very smart colleague, David Sanger, excellent guy. I agreed. He then laid out his plan to counterattack. Bernie Sanders said it, and I'm going to use it all over the place because it's true, Trump said. She is a woman who is ill-suited to be president because she has bad judgment. We bantered about The Apprentice a little. Can you believe Schwarzenegger thinks he can do it? Then I said something I never should have said. Thanks very much for calling, Mr. Trump. I've been covering Hillary since 2007.